Rachel Feltman is a science blogger for the Washington Post, and she's very enjoyable reading because she's funny and interested in a lot of things, and her columns are always good. So I thought it might be fun to talk to her. She's joining us now from New York City, Rachel Feltman from the Washington Post. Hey, Rachel. Hey, Rachel.
Hey, how's it going?
Pretty good. Yourself?
I'm doing great.
Now, Feltman is with a T, not Feldman, which is me, with a D.
Right.
Okay, glad we straightened that out. Because there was
a
lot of...
I have a Michael Feltman, so... Between you and Corey Feldman, I pretended to have a lot of famous uncles growing up.
Yeah.
So...
Who is your Michael Feltman?
My uncle Michael Feltman is not on the radio.
No.
And I suspect the two of you have never met. But great uncle. So.
He's a good uncle?
Yeah, best.
did he give you more than like a dollar on occasions?
He was pretty good with birthdays.
Yeah.
You have never sent me a birthday card. So.
No, never. Because I don't even know if you're a Feldman, you know, if it's just a matter of a letter or if it's more than that.
Yeah.
Could be more than that.
I think the difference in spelling is that, you know, I think it's the same family. It's like one of those Ellis Island things.
It could have been. Or it could be that the Feltmans were in Felt.
And opposed to Feld.
The Feldmans were in Feld. Yeah.
Right.
Which means field, and Felt means felt. So it's a whole rigmarole. But you know what, Rachel, though, at one point you were defending yourself against some creationists who thought you offended them or something, and right? And you said, well,
right.
I'll tell my parents because they're devout Episcopalians or something like that. Now,
my parents are Protestants and have not yet disowned me for writing about evolution. So.
Yeah, they're Protestants. Rachel, come on now. Rachel Feltman is a Protestant name? I don't think so.
No. My dad's family is very Jewish, but.
So you're just you're self-identified as Protestant? Is that what you're saying?
We are a modern interfaith household, Michael.
Oh, okay. All right. Oh, no, it's not a big deal, but I was just shocked when I said, those great. Do the creationists bother you a lot? Do they feel offended by some of your comments? Because you're quite funny in a lot of things you write about.
Oh, thank you. I do get a lot of emails from people who are really mad at me for not paying attention to real scientific facts, like how the Earth is only 6,000 years old.
4,000.
Really want me to educate myself.
Yeah.
4,004
BC, but, October 23rd, I think it was.
But you know, most of the angry emails I get are more people mad at me because I called someone sexist, or I don't know, because I am a girl who writes about science.
Yeah.
The creationists have actually been relatively kind.
It's the scientists
that's not saying a lot.
It's the scientists you can't stand, right? Because male.
Oh yeah, I hate scientists. They're the worst.
But there's a lot of, a woman working in science, there's a lot of sexism in the lab, right?
There is, there is. And I write a lot about issues of the underrepresentation of women in science and the harassment they face. And so that's something that I do get a lot of, let's call it, interesting feedback for.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, but the story is, now, are you considered a blogger or a columnist?
I'm a blogger.
Because bloggers, they don't pay? They don't pay bloggers? Is that the difference?
No, so I have a blog for the Washington Post called Speaking of Science.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting question what the difference between that and a column is, but I am a blogger.
Yeah.
And I think the blog is pretty good. Do you read it?
Yes, I do.
I get the feeling that you do.
That's how I thought. Well, and then I saw it a few times, and then I saw your name was Feltman, so I thought it probably related. Well, let's get her on here and talk about some of these things.
I appreciate it.
You were trained in science, right?
I was. I studied environmental science as an undergrad, and then went right into science writing because I like telling people about science. I like learning things and then being a know-it-all and telling people all about them. Mm-hmm. So science writing is the perfect job for me.
Yeah. Okay. Let's go through some of the things that you've written about here. The world's first sure. penis transplant was reportedly resulted in a pregnancy. That's a
yeah. Great news.
Okay. All right, nothing more to say about that. Three cheers for Samantha Cristoforetti, smasher of space records.
Yeah, so Samantha is an Italian astronaut for the European Space Agency, mm-hmm. and she was on the International Space Station and just finished her last mission, which was the longest single mission for a woman in space, and also I think the longest single mission for any European Space Agency astronaut.
Mm-hmm.
So that's awesome. And also while she was up there, she did some really great public outreach. She did a lot of really cool videos, and she tweeted with people all the time. And I just love that because ever since Chris Hadfield, the Canadian astronaut, you know, really took the opportunity to, like, become a social media darling,
mm-hmm.
I feel like that just helps the interest in space and science so much because astronauts are really cool, and if people get the opportunity to see how cool they are, it just makes it so much easier to get them excited about space.
Yeah. Have you spoken with her?
I haven't.
Yeah. That would be a columnist I've would do that, right? Probably. Yeah. Actually speak to her.
Yeah. I have gotten to speak to some astronauts, but not Christina yet. So
yeah. Well, that's very
good. Samantha, yeah. Hopefully.
The Non-Apology of the Year award goes to Nobel scientist who thinks women just cry all the time. There you go, right? In a nutshell?
Yeah, that pretty much covers it.
Tim Hunt, that was?
Yeah.
What did he win for?
He won for physiology and medicine for his work on cell division.
Yeah.
So really important science. But there's this kind of ongoing problem where Nobel laureates, mm-hmm. they get this platform and then sometimes say really horrible things.
Yeah.
So Watson of, you know, Watson and Crick fame, yeah. he's considered the father of DNA, he's gotten in trouble for saying some really racist and sexist things and then being really upset when people, you know, try to call him out for it.
Yeah.
And Tim Hunt, I was speaking to a group of science journalists at a conference and said, in my experience, what women do when you get them in the lab is they fall in love with you and you fall in love with them and they cry when you criticize them and they should just be in their own labs. And he said later it was a joke, but people who were there say it was really not a joke.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Yeah. But there's been some fallout there. And,
yeah.
And also in my email inbox. So
yeah, and on Twitter, I suppose it's lit up Twitter, I would imagine.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And dinosaurs. Dinosaurs are always very big. Anyway,
<Yeah.
laughs> is there actually one called Dreadnoughtus?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Is that a size-related slur?
Yeah. It was supposed to be the largest, the heaviest terrestrial animal ever measured. So basically the biggest thing that wasn't a giant sea monster that has ever
biggest thing on land ever.
Estimated.
How big was it? It was supposed to be.
Oh gosh.
Dreadnoughtus.
I want to say the estimate was 60 tons.
Mm-hmm.
It was maybe 80 tons. It was big.
It was big.
It dwarfed like anything else we have measurements for.
Mm-hmm.
But
they found out it wasn't that big?
Well, now some researchers say they estimated that it wasn't that big. But it really comes down to how difficult it is to measure dinosaurs. I mean, you can't really get them on the scale.
Right.
So it's really, you have to pick some kind of method of estimation based on the information you have. Like the bones you have, or, you know, trying to figure out what the volume of the dinosaur was. And a lot of those methods come up with different numbers. So the truth is, We don't really know how much Dreadnought has weighed, but it was probably really big and really heavy. But when it comes to picking out an actual number, that's probably, you know, different people are going to come up with different things.
Okay, so it's lost weight, though, some weight. So.
Yeah.
Okay,
yep.
The hard way. All right, now here we go again. So now, speaking of dinosaurs, all right, scientist discovers new dinosaur, sneaks marriage proposal into the study.
Oh, yeah.
Is this it again with the science guys? What's going on here?
Yeah. So this was a new dinosaur. So it was pretty cool. It was like a relative of the Triceratops. And someone realized that in the acknowledgments of the paper, he had asked his girlfriend to marry him. And everyone was very excited and very, we were all like, oh, on Twitter all day.
Yeah.
And there's usually a lot of romance in the world of writing about dinosaurs. So it was a nice change of pace. It did turn out that he had proposed to her officially when he had her read the unsubmitted manuscript.
Oh,
so it's
nice.
Not like he like got this paper published and was then like, surprise. Which is probably good. That might be a little bit of a bold move. But I think people are pretty sure it's the first time it's ever happened. So, you know, don't propose at a baseball game, just discover a new dinosaur.
Yeah. Scientists are socially ill at ease, is what I think it is. Like engineers. You ever notice that engineer go to a party where there's an engineer of some sort? They're always nice guys. Especially
well,
mechanical ones, you know, they're great. But, you know, they're a little socially ill at ease. Maybe that's part of it, you know, in terms of these. I mean, this is actually a good example of a nice thing, but could have been terrible if she, you know, hated him.
Oh, yeah.
And got that. And had to read his paper and got that. You know, that would be terrible. We have a new walking, is this like a walking catfish? Invasive fish live for days on land and walks on its gills. Because this is like an important fish then, isn't it? Because it's kind of in between land and water.
Yeah, so there are fish that are kind of, they live kind of amphibiously. They, you know, they can, like, drag around in the mud and survive without being, like, submerged in water for a while.
Yeah.
So it's not totally new that this fish does this. It is pretty creepy that it drags itself along using its gills. And also it tends to kill things that try to eat it because it like, gets stuck in their throats because of these scary walking gills it has.
Yeah.
So it's a little freaky.
Yeah.
But the reason scientists are worried about it is because it's kind of creeping closer and closer to being on the Australian mainland, and probably going from island to island, you know, being stuck on the bottom of fishing boats and things like that, which is really common for invasive species. They kind of, all you need is a couple to make it from one place to another.
They have suckers as well as walking gills?
They don't have suckers, but they can get kind of like caught up in nets of fish that are being caught and carried over. And if those fish are kept alive on the boat. So what happens is that a couple of them make it to the new place, and because they don't have natural predators there, they just, like, have the run of the place, and it's really bad for the natural ecosystem there. So, yeah, these walking, choking land fish.
Is that their name? Is that the scientific name for it?
I think they're called... the climbing perch, because actually I think one of the first people
I like perch,
who found them on one of the first people who found them on land saw them in a tree and thought that they had climbed up there. If I'm remembering this correctly, they had in fact probably been like dropped there by a bird, but they do walk around on land. And yeah, so hopefully we will be able to keep them out of Australia so they don't add to the collection of terrifying things there.
Yeah, so what I see in this scenario is the bird tried to eat it, right, and couldn't stand whatever it's got there, the bristles or something, right, or his feet.
Mm-hmm.
It's got, like, feet, and regurgitated it into a tree is what I think. Likely scenario, don't you think?
I guess that's probably what went down there, yeah.
Either that or a water spout. Possibly could have just left it there. Oh, we should go into the forensics together. We could do scientific forensic studies of how, you know, fish get in trees. And when fish rain, you know, they have these things where fish rain every so often. Usually they're cod, I think. And I like cod, you know, so if it happens on me, I'm not going to be upset. But, you know, fish, how does that happen? That's, I think, a water spout or something. Do you ever run into that raining of fish?
Story? Yeah, you know, I've never covered a raining fish story. Yeah. We did have one the other day that was blood-sucking fish falling from the sky, but that was because birds carry them and then drop them, probably because they're so ugly. Oh. So then you have these, like, scary fish covered in like, blood-sucking teeth just, like, being dropped into the middle of landlocked areas, which is very disconcerting for the people who live there, especially because they were still alive. So.
Okay. Well, I'm glad I brought it up then. This was interesting. This engine that uses nothing but water and bacteria to power small devices. This is a wonderful use for bacteria, for, you know, useless bacteria right now. Could be used to power an engine.
Yeah. Basically, these bacterial spores, they contract and expand based on the moisture in the air.
Uh-huh.
So by controlling, by basically exposing them to water to make the engine area more humid, these spores expand. And then as they use up all the water, they contract. And by kind of attaching the bacteria to this plastic, they create sort of like an artificial muscle. You know, it like expands and contracts because of all the bacteria on it.
Yeah.
So you can use that to power small devices. And they're hoping they'll be able to scale it up. I mean, right now they can power like a toy car with it. And these very small devices, but, you know, it's using nothing but bacteria and water and air, so, you know, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's going to be a tough sell, you know, you want a bacteria lung-driven device. But I think if they can finesse the naming of it, I think it'd be an interesting thing. When in your science training, which area of science were you in, like, microbiology, or what was your kind of major interest?
I mean, so I did like environmental science in college, but I read a lot about bacteria because there's a lot of cool stuff going on with bacteria in us and around us right now. And I read about space a lot, especially astrobiology. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of cool space stuff happening in the next few months. You know, in our constant search for life. Intelligent life anywhere, even here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Bill Nye's light sail, that thing, that was, wasn't that part of science fiction originally? Somebody.
Yeah, I think it was an Arthur C. Clarke book. I know that because every time I write about light sail without mentioning Arthur C. Clarke, I get about 5 emails. So it's this solar sail. So
yeah.
It works like a sail with wind, but it uses particles from the sun to push it. And Bill Nye and the Planetary Society just did their first successful prototype test of a light sail. And it was really simple. The test was just to see if they could get the sail to deploy because it's really thin. It's like less than the width of a human hair, and it's like as big as a boxing ring. So knowing that it's able to unfurl without being damaged is important. And they've already raised the money to have a full mission next year where they actually, you know, try to accomplish something with the satellite it's attached to. So that'll be cool.
Yeah. It's not, you know, the solar sail that flies on solar wind is interesting, but the most amazing thing about this story is that Bill Nye does something useful. You know, I mean, he's actually involved in a project. I thought he was just the guy, you know, Bill Nye, the scientist, you know, and he jumps up. So that was cool. Rachel,
yeah.
I want to thank you for your time. Do you live in Washington? Or you stay in New York?
I am in New York now.
Yeah. Okay. I don't know if the Post makes you live in town or not. I have no idea.
Well, I convinced them to let me come back to New York, but I am a bi-city resident.
Good.
So.
And there's a lot of science going on in New York. We know that.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Rachel, thanks so much. Rachel Feltman from the Washington Post. She blogs science. It's cool. Read it. Thanks, Rachel.
Thank you.
Yeah, hey.